This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Penn-Cava. Our Christmas gift to you this year is a collection of stories from North Carolinians about their Christmases past and their lines of work in the present. We start off with Doug Marlette, the political cartoonist who lives in Hillsboro. Marlette's comic strip Kudzu is set in the, we think, fictional town of Bypass, North Carolina. And one of Kudzu's more famous characters and Bypass's chief cleric is the Reverend Will B. Dunn. This time of year, there's a Christmas pageant to put on, which, to mix religious metaphors, has become the Reverend Dunn's cross to bear. Doug Marlette.
Well, Reverend Dunn oversees it, and everyone participates every year. But I think it's become problematic with Ida May, who is the Christmas pageant monitor. She monitors everything.
She's the monitor, so she's not even the director.
She participates, but she's kind of the ombudsperson, as she would have it.
And so how does Ida May make herself felt there?
Well, she is always checking it for spiritual correctness. I mean, she's always screening everything, Christmas carols. She talks about problem carols. There are problem carols, things that come up in Christmas carols that are not, kosher. I don't know if we'd say that, but I can give you examples, would you like to?
Sure, please do.
This is her introduction. Ida May says, "Welcome to the annual Bypass Baptist Christmas pageant. The script has been monitored for insensitivity and lack of inclusiveness. No animals or other living creatures were harmed in preparation for this production." And Reverend Will B. Dunn stands off to the side saying, "Although a part of me dies every time she says that." they're always in tension, and of course, conflict creates humor.
There you go. Now, so the Reverend Will B. Dunn is long-suffering when it comes to these pageants?
Yes. He represents the old-time religion, and she represents kind of secular humanism, and so there's that clash that we see, especially in the contemporary South.
So this is a mine you can go back to over and over.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. No, any time there's reverence, it calls for irreverence. And putting these things on, these pageants are really grueling and tough things. I went through lots of them, cantatas, growing up Southern Baptist. I've played every role. So I've watched my son play the roles and sing the songs. And so it's tough enough to pull this off with the story. But having to also toe the line with spiritual correctness makes it even tougher.
So you grew up Southern Baptist,
right?
And you performed in a number of these.
Oh yeah, oh yeah.
So what was your favorite role?
I really enjoyed the Holy Spirit, because I didn't. I was everywhere and nowhere, and I was I was probably more likely. I was one of the barnyard animals, as I recall. And mooing, and I think maybe once I was the angel Michael or Gabriel. I always confuse those guys. I may have been one of the wise men. I may have been one of the shepherds at various times. You do it a lot. This is year after year.
This may be a heretical question in the minds of some listeners, but as a young baby, did you ever play the starring role in one of those?
No, we had a light
scenes?
Bulb for that. That was the light bulb was cast as the baby Jesus, and that's the so you don't see it. And sometimes there would be live babies that would be.
No, wait, was this a lit light bulb?
Yes, it was lit, but that's the glow, the aura.
What is your favorite part of Christmas?
I love the music, frankly. I really do. I love hearing Christmas carols. And growing up Southern Baptist, we did not have. I remember when "O Come All Ye Faithful" was new. At least it felt new, and it was because my father's in the service, and our Catholic friends played "O Come All Ye Faithful," and it was not really part of the Southern Baptist. This is a long time ago, but it was. And I remember hearing, just falling in love with that carol. It was completely new to me at about age 5 or 6.
See, I didn't realize that there had been some carols that took time to get adapted by different faiths.
Now, this just may be totally my experience, but I remember it as being new and just thinking it was just wonderful.
What was it about it?
It was so, memorable. It was so, it got under your skin. I just saw Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby in White Christmas the other night. And amazing that must have been 1950, right? 52, something like that. That White Christmas, that song that is now a classic, just debuted in that film. Mm-hmm. But we always think of these things as being eternal and always being there. There was a beginning.
Are there any guilty pleasures for you when it comes to Christmas? Things that you think, yeah, I shouldn't really like this,
I was just thinking of those chocolate-covered cherries that they sell in the drugstore. You know, the little chocolate. I used to think I would get that as a gift and give that as a gift when I was a child, chocolate-covered cherries. But it's amazing how quickly that sickens you. It makes you want to throw up. But when I was a kid, you know, you would just that was something. It was about Christmas. The smell of tangerines. That's another Christmassy smell. It doesn't make sense. That's a Florida, you know, citrus. But for some reason, that's part of the Christmas thing.
Well, you grew up in Florida.
I grew up around
growing around the South,
Mississippi, Florida, but that I remember getting those things, getting tangerines in my stocking.
What's the best Christmas gift you ever received?
Oh, let's see. Okay. I think I got a Revolutionary War set, which was I was really into history when I was about 8 years old, and I had the little British soldiers and the blue colonialists, and I had the whole thing. That was really a great Christmas. That's my favorite, I think.
What parts of your family's traditions do you keep alive? Is there any one particular tradition that stands out, you think, in your
stocking,
family?
The stockings. And my wife is responsible for keeping that. And she came from a large family of six kids. There were only three in my family. But that is one of the traditions of – and that was new to me. And it's interesting how you merge these things with marriage, that was a very big deal, the stockings. For us, it was kind of an afterthought. You had little gifts in the stockings. But for her and her family, that was a major part of it. And so we've taken on that. And so the stocking's a big thing.
Mm-hmm. Your line of work requires a very sharpness. And I'm wondering if that's more difficult to do at the holiday season?
Well, anytime there's vacations and that kind of spirit, people get duller. And, you know, like when you go to the beach and, you know, it takes you an hour just to go get a loaf of bread, just to motivate yourself. And so Christmas – no, but actually Christmas inspires for cartoons. I mean, there's lots of material. You can keep re-entering this. The images makes political cartooning easier, and the comic strip too. It's a lot of fun to revisit these pageants and the different angles on it.
Because you've come back to them year after year.
Yeah, and there's so much to mine there. There's so many ways to do it, and especially with this as the culture keeps struggling with these issues of religion and separation of church and state, and can you have Christmas pageants? Can you have manger scenes? All of those things. It makes right. You know, in the strip and in the book, I had Reverend Will Be Done buying the Ten Commandments on eBay. You got the version that was banned in Alabama, and he took it back to bypass North Carolina, which of course was crossing state lines for moral purposes, and that got him in trouble. But all of these things are great fodder.
I want to come back to Reverend Will Be Done, your character, one of your many characters. But some ministers this time of year might stress that Christians have lost sight of the true meaning of Christmas and they focus too much on material things.
Mm-hmm.
Would the Reverend Done sermonize that way?
Well, I'm sure he would, but just like all of those ministers who talk about it, I mean, this is an ancient problem. I mean, this is materialism. I mean, we live in a culture of materialism, bottom line culture. And even the people who complain about it are materialists. And that's the interesting thing. That's why one draws a comic strip with these things, because whenever you have that kind of hypocrisy where people are upholding certain values and then living another way, I mean, Will Be Done, who preaches certain things and then acts on his humanness, his ambition, his aggression, his lust for power, whatever, you get comedy with that. The same with political cartoons. But, you know, I did a political cartoon of on the Grinch movie a year or so ago, and I had people coming out talking about what a wonderful send-up of greed and materialism in our culture as they're walking out with a $6 popcorn. I mean, if you go to a movie, you know, you're paying $6-$8 for a popcorn, for a drink. You walk out, you spend $25. You know, and that was I remember walking out of the Grinch and thinking about it. What a wonderful send-up of greed in our culture. I mean, no place is it more vivid than in the line of buying, you know, soft drinks. And, you know, so anyway, yeah, we all get sentimental. We're weeping about it. So it's an ongoing thing. Materialism, I think, is one of the greatest, you know, plagues of modern America, for sure.
So Will Be Done and the other characters turn up in your books, which are compendiums of your comic strips over the years. But these characters also show up in your Christmas cards that you send out to friends.
Right, right.
And you have this year's version with you.
I have. This is a Sunday page, and it's Kudzu with the little snow-covered church. They're singing We Three Kings of Orient Are, and you hear Cut from it. And Ida May, with her little Santa hat, who is the monitor, says, "Preacher, a sensitivity monitor for spiritual correctness of your pageant, I've gone over your script, and I have a few suggestions. We Three Royalty of Asia Are would be less gender-specific, don't you think? God rest ye merry gentle persons. For unto us a child is born, an offspring is given." And this character named Tiny Tim, totally insensitive, loaded with negative cultural bias. And Will Be Done says, "What would you suggest we call him?" "Differently imposing Tim." And Will Be Done says, "God help us everyone." That's the Christmas card.
Well, bless you all. Doug Marlett, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Doug Marlett is a cartoonist and writer in Hillsboro. His most recent collection of kudzu cartoons is called A Town So Backwards, Even the Episcopalians Handle Snakes.
How'd you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? How'd you like to spend the holiday away across the sea? How'd you like to spend Christmas on Christmas Island? How'd you like to hang your stocking on a great big coconut tree?
Coming up, a rock critic's take on the season and the music of it, and softening a bit on songs once scorned. Support for The State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays. I'm Melinda Pencava. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We continue our tour down the Christmas memory lanes of North Carolinians, heading now to Madison County, where musician and storyteller Sheila K. Adams grew up. In the town of Sodom, Sheila K. Adams and her family celebrated two Christmases each year. One was the holiday with Santa on December 25th, and the other 12 days later on the 6th of January. That day, that 12th day of Christmas, they called the real or the old Christmas.
Well, old Christmas was celebrated on January the 6th, and there was not much, I guess you'd say, active celebration. It was a pretty solemn occasion. We'd go to church, and then we would spend kind of the evening quiet at home. There wasn't any television, and that was what my family said was the true birthday of Jesus, was on that January the 6th. And so January the 5th, the evening, and then all day on January the 6th. And even if we went to school, although I can remember early on, Melinda, they didn't have school on January the 6th when I was in like first and second grade.
This idea of the real or the old Christmas, what's that stem from? Is that Epiphany that we're talking about here, the 12th day of Christmas?
You know, I think it has something to do with back when they changed the calendar. And I've heard a couple of different things. I've heard that when we begin to celebrate, as Christians, the birth of Christ, that there were so many pagan holidays that centered around the winter solstice that they decided to change when they celebrated the birth of Jesus from the 1st of January to correspond more with these pagan celebrations so that they could do away with them. Because the Druids, I think, over in the British Isles celebrated winter solstice. And so I think that's kind of where they were heading, was trying to get the focus away from pagan religions. But
they couldn't rub it out entirely, but they had to adapt to it. Is that right?
Exactly. I mean, because they were having sort of these pagan celebrations at the end of December, and then they were having this Christian celebration in January, and I think they just moved it to December.
Well, Sheila K. Adams, you work not only as a storyteller but also as a musician, and you have a Christmas carol for us, don't you?
I do. It's called the Cherry Tree Carol, and it's I learned it from one of the love song singers over there around home named Inez Chandler. She was was really special. She was a real character and was one of those people that didn't have a filter between her brain and her mouth. And so pretty much what she thought came straight out. And this is one of the few songs that I learned from her that was not sort of off color, I'll say. But this is Inez's version of the Cherry Tree Carol. When Joseph was an old man, and an old man was he, he courted Mary, sweet Virgin Mary, the Queen of Galilee. Joseph and Mary, they went walking in an orchard so green, where there were berries and there were cherries as thick as could be seen. Oh, then bespoke sweet Mary, Mary so meek and so mild, pick me one berry, pick me one cherry, for I am with child. Oh, then bespoke old Joseph, in a voice that was unkind, let him pick berries, let him pick cherries that brought thee now with child. Oh, then bespoke the sweet baby from within his mother's womb. Bow down, thou tallest tree that my mother might have won. Then bowest down the tallest tree, right into sweet Mary's hand. Oh, see here, Joseph. Oh, see now, Joseph. I have cherries at command. Oh, then bespoke old Joseph, I have done Mary wrong. Fear not, my dearest dear, and be thou not cast down. So Joseph married his sweet Mary, Mary so meek and so mild, and on that Christmas, that cold Christmas, she delivered forth her child. What will you name this child, Mary? Mary so meek and so mild, I'll name him Jesus, sweet baby Jesus, for he is the Christ child.
That is lovely. Thank you so much, Sheila K. Adams.
Well, thank you, Melinda.
Thank you. Now, and the name of that song is?
The Cherry Tree Carol.
And that was something that Inez Chandler passed down to you? Or had she come up with that one? Or was that a traditional song that she kept alive?
Yeah, she said that she learned that from her grandmother.
Your family sang together at the holidays?
They did. We always had a Christmas play, and over there in Sodom, it was like a lot of little mountain communities. Everybody in the community was related in some fashion, and so whenever they would have the Christmas play, it was more like a family gathering than it was anything else. And I can remember a couple of different plays. One I played Mary in. I wasn't really impressed by that. Mary didn't say a whole lot. And she had to sit still for a long time.
She didn't get to tell stories or sing?
No, she didn't get to tell any stories or sing. She just sat there and looked maternal. And so I wasn't too fond of that one. But there was one year when I played this kind of feisty old woman. And I remember it was really neat because I got to dye my hair gray, put that gray hairspray on it. Mm-hmm. And she was really sassy. And so I got a great part in the Christmas play that year and just loved it.
Now, was this part of the manger scene?
Well, it was, you know, it was more of a, I guess you'd call it, modern-day Christmas play, that this old woman was not in the spirit of Christmas. And so, of course, what happens by the end of the play is that she understands that Christmas is very special, and then everybody goes to the manger scene. So,
because I thought I had missed the older woman with the gray hair from all the manger scenes I'd seen growing up, you know.
Right.
Three wise men might have had gray hair, but there wasn't a woman in there.
Yeah, well, I played one of the wise men one time, too. That was pretty neat. You got to wear a beard and everything.
Now, did you ever get to sing in those?
I would sing the song that I just sang for you, the Cherry Tree Carol, was requested a whole lot, you know, during the Christmas plays and that sort of thing. So I always, even if I didn't have a part in the Christmas play itself, I always got to stand up and sing the Cherry Tree Carol.
Great. Well, Sheila Kay Adams, thank you so much for talking with us and singing for us today. And I guess I should wish you two Merry Christmases because you celebrate both.
Right. And the same to you.
Sheila Kay Adams is a writer, musician, and storyteller. She lives in Madison County near Asheville.
Mark Kemp grew up in Asheboro, and he traveled the world as a music journalist while working for Rolling Stone magazine and MTV. He came home to North Carolina recently to live and work as the entertainment editor for the Charlotte Observer. Mark Kemp's book, Dixie Lullaby, chronicles Southern rock and Mark's own travels through the music and musical landscape of America. And Mark says that part of that journey began as a teenager with a Christmas gift of an album.
I remember getting Frank Zappa's Apostrophe. I think that was like on my 14th, when I was 14 years old. And it was the most weird, bizarre album I think I'd ever heard up to that point. I grew up listening to the Rolling Stones and a lot of the bands that I talk about in the book, the Almonds, you know, bands from around this area of the country. And I got that Frank Zappa album and put it on, and it just kind of opened up a whole new door or a whole new window of music for me.
Now, was this something that you had said to your parents or someone, you know, I want this album, or was this something that somebody gave to you thinking, well, maybe I'm going to, maybe I'll corrupt young Mark's mind with some Frank Zappa?
No, I actually read a lot of rock magazines like Rolling Stone and Cream, and I had read about it, and I'd read about Frank Zappa's, you know, past being, you know, with the Mothers of Invention in San Francisco, and I just thought, you know, and I'd heard The Grateful Dead and Jefferson Airplane, so I thought, you know, this guy's probably equally weird, so I'd like to hear his music, and it was weirder,
yeah.
Weirder than I expected.
Yeah. So now you grew up and then moved away from North Carolina for a number of years because you were working in as a writer at Rolling Stone and at MTV. You lived in L.A. and New York. Is there a particular holiday memory from any of those places that you decided, I'm not in Asheboro anymore?
Oh, yeah. When I first got to New York back in the late 80s, mid to late 80s, my first Christmas there was awesome because all of those things that I used to see on television, like the big tree up in Midtown and you know, the storefronts with their amazingly beautiful Christmas decorations, I got to go see. And, you know, most of the time around Christmas time, it's snowing or it's just so cold that it feels like Christmas. New York to me feels like the Christmases that we get in the images, the media images. That's real Christmas, and so that was exciting. And then in L.A., my first Christmas was the most bizarre Christmas I'd ever had because it's warm, you know. It's warm and you still have the sun and you still have the beach. You know, it's like the endless summer Christmas. So both of them were quite exciting. I mean, nothing's quite like being home, you know, here being home For Christmas, just because of the family and the friends that you see. But, you know, I do miss I miss New York now a lot.
Because of that, as you said, that real image of Christmas, it being cold and snowy, because of all those images we've been given over the years.
Yeah, it feels like Christmas. It feels like the Christmas that, you know, you're supposed to have, you know, like the real Santa Claus.
Did you come home for Christmas a lot in those years, you know, to come visit for Christmas?
I did sometimes. Sometimes I would come down for Thanksgiving. Sometimes I'd come down for Christmas. But I spent a number of Christmases up there or over there, in the case of L.A.
Is there a holiday soundtrack in your head of those years away from North Carolina?
Yeah, the Beach Boys Christmas album. Right now, that's in my head just because I just recently listened to it again. They just reissued it, and it's just so amazing. For all those contradictory reasons that I mentioned about being in L.A. for Christmas, if nothing else.
Yeah. What in particular stands out?
You know, I mean, you get the Beach Boys singing Christmas songs with those sunny California harmonies, you know, which is a huge contradiction, but somehow it works, you know. The same songs that you hear, you know, fun, 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 and, you know, the Endless Summer lyrics and all that, the same very sound you hear. You hear them doing Christmas songs, and it's just a wonderful Christmas album.
Well, way up north where the air gets cold, there's a tale about Christmas that you've all been told, and a real famous cat all dressed up in red, and he spends the whole year working out in his sled. It's the Little Saint Nick, Little Saint Nick. It's the Little Saint Nick, Little Saint Nick.
Another one that comes to mind when I think of Christmas is the Phil Spector Christmas album, and Ronnie Spector singing with the same voice that she sings Be My Baby with. She's singing I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus.
That's right.
It's more like I Saw Mommy Kissing Santa Claus.
That's very good. Your time in New York paid off, didn't it?
Yeah, I learned a little.
Now, your book, Dixie Lullaby, was about your appreciation as a teenager of Southern rock, then not appreciating it, and then coming back to see its value. Were there any Southern rock Christmas songs?
Not that I remember from then. I think since then, Charlie Daniels may have put out a Christian album. I mean, he's put out a lot of Christian albums, but a Christmas album. And I think others have. And I think that really rarely works. It worked in the case of the Phil Spector. It worked for the Beach Boys. But when rock stars or rock musicians or musicians... who are real super identified with kind of an alternative sound. You know what I mean? When they try to do Christmas songs, it's either one, it sounds really corny, cornier than Bing Crosby doing it, or it sounds so parodied that it's kind of just dorky, you know? So I don't remember any of those Southern bands doing Christmas songs per se.
Is it because of the beat of rock and roll? It just doesn't lend itself to the jingly kind of carol, the chirpy kind of carol?
I guess the beat and the edge, the sort of attitude, it kind of flies against a lot, you know, Jingle Bells or Rudolph. If done right, parodying them works. You know, I think the Phil Spector album, to a great degree, is a bunch of groups kind of parodying rock Christmas songs, but it's turned into one of the best Christmas collections that I know of because of their revamping of traditional songs. But still, I think, you know, for instance, if Mick Jagger were to do an album of Christmas songs, it would just sound ridiculous, because no matter whether he likes those songs or if he's come around to those songs again, it just doesn't fit with the Mick Jagger persona. And like recently, Rod Stewart did a couple of albums of standards. It just does not come off as, I don't know, real or authentic, or even though it may be. It's just difficult to listen to a rocker known for Do You Think I'm Sexy doing standards. It just doesn't work.
But, you know, of course, there was that pairing of David Bowie and Bing Crosby. doing Little Drummer Boy.
Yes, and that's one of the few in which, like, an old guy and a young rock star working together worked, because I don't think it was so overdone at that point that it seemed silly or stupid. It just seemed kind of sweet.
They told me, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, a newborn king to see, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum. Our finest gifts we bring, ba-rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum, rum-ba-bum-bum.
But it was an odd pairing at that time with David.
Really,
David
strange.
Bowie was quite glittery at that stage, wasn't he?
Yeah, I mean, he had gone from being the Ziggy Stardust character to whatever new guys he was at the time. And here he was with Bing Crosby, you know, a favorite of all of our parents. And but somehow it worked, you know. Somehow those two voices worked together, and it didn't come off as either kind of dorky or parody. It just seemed kind of genuine.
You can let down your guard at the season, perhaps. Maybe that's this time of year that lets you do that.
Yeah, when you can get together with the old folks. The young folks can get together with the old folks and just kind of put all that negativity or whatever behind, you know, that rock and roll kind of stirs up.
Well, Mark Kemp, happy holidays to you. Thanks so much for being with us.
Well, happy holidays to you too, Melinda. Thanks so much.
Mark Kemp is the author of Dixie Lullaby and the entertainment editor of the Charlotte Observer. He joined us from the studios of WFAE in Charlotte.
I saw mommy kissing Santa Claus underneath the mistletoe last night.
I'm Melinda Pencava. We have more in the stocking from our holiday memories in North Carolina. It's just ahead on The State of Things. This is The State of Things. I'm Melinda Pencava. We continue now with our collection of holiday recollections from North Carolinians. Jeffrey Beam is now the assistant to the biology librarian in the botany section of the library at UNC Chapel Hill. He is also the author of 17 works of poems. Jeffrey Beam grew up in Kannapolis when it was what he calls a feudal state. Cannon Mills, he says, owned most of the town, employed most everyone there. And the Cannon family was quite generous. And each Christmas there was a parade that went through town. It featured Santa on a sleigh. But the float that came just before Santa was called the Possum Float. And that is what Jeffrey Beam remembers the most.
It was, in retrospect, quite horrible. But, of course, it was the most popular float in the parade. It was a float with a bare tree with 20 or more live possums hanging in complete terror on the tree limbs, with 4 or 5 hunters with their guns from the Possum Hunter Club and their dogs, and the dogs just tearing up the world, you know, trying to get to these possums that were hanging from this tree. And this float went around to all the neighboring towns, but it was... How we love to see things suffer. Yeah. And here we are, you know, celebrating the birth of Christ with this parade and the arrival of Santa Claus. And here's this thing that's so horrible but fascinating.
I don't know if that's a reminder of naughty or nice. what were the origins of this?
I have no idea. And I don't know when it disappeared, but it must have been probably in the feel-good 70s.
So you did move away from Kannapolis in the 70s. You came to Chapel Hill, and you were married then.
Yes.
You've since been divorced, and for the past 25 years, you've been living with a man.
Yes.
You came out during this time.
Yes.
So is there a ritual or a tradition that has stayed with you through all that, or are there Christmases that are associated with those transitions that you've made?
Well, I've always loved Christmas trees. And the first year my wife and I were married, we had an absolutely wonderful tree. We were incredibly poor. I was in school full-time and working full-time. My wife was working full-time to help put me through school. We were living in a real slum of an apartment. And she was working at Zayre's, which was a department chain like Kmart or Target. We went out and bought this very expensive tree in Charlotte, as I remember, brought it back to Kannapolis, put it up, went out and bought way too many Christmas ornaments, created this beautiful Christmas tree, which our cat promptly crawled up into and pulled down and destroyed every ornament on the tree. And then we had to go out and buy new ornaments. You know, where we got the money for this, I have no idea. Near the end of our marriage, I became friends with someone here who is a professor in the dental school here, Ron Strauss. Ron and I spent a lot of time talking as we became friends about our different experiences. He grew up in New York, Jewish. I grew up in Kannapolis, Methodist. And he started joining in on decorating our Christmas tree. So he and his family has continued to do that for what I guess amounts to 28 years for him. He married a year or two after I met him, has two daughters, one who is in a freshman at Ann Arbor and one who's a senior here at UNC. And except for 1 year when the first daughter was a baby and they spent that year in a kibbutz in Israel, we have decorated the Christmas tree every year since then. And there are other friends that come and go, but the Strauss-Slatkoffs have been constant with this tree decorating for at least 28 years. It could be 29 even.
Well, Jeffrey Beam, I was hoping you could share a holiday poem with us.
Yes, I have one. This is from my book, The Fountain, and I haven't written a lot of Christmas poems, and this is probably the most obvious Christmas one, although it really is that moment when the angel comes to Mary and announces the forthcoming birth. So it's called Annunciation. She asked only that her purity be a lily flower, and from her womb might come children, wholesome as fish and as green. Why should an angel announce this blessing on her, a lowly carpenter's wife? Even if David's song silkens her blood and Joseph's, what myrrh can she give? To give life to a fleshless soul was her one hope, not countless resonating sanctities, palpable as figs and glowing pomegranates. Still, joy confounds the common Galilean light. In her smock folds, she feels the whole earth turning, while barley burnishes summery fields.
It's the Annunciation from Jeffrey Beam. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me.
And a happy holiday. Merry Christmas.
Same to you. Same to everyone.
Jeffrey Beam is the assistant to the biology librarian in the botany section of a library at UNC Chapel Hill. He's also the author of 17 works of poems, including Midwinter Fires, The Fountain, Submergences, and a spoken word 2-CD collection, What We Have Lost.
Thank you.
As we've been hearing this hour, stories are a central part of the holidays. Craig Coker, now the acting dean of Duke Chapel, has a story he remembers at this time of year that was a particular favorite of his father.
The name of this story is Why the Chimes Rang, from 1906 by Raymond MacDonald Alden. There was once, in a faraway country, where few people have ever traveled, a wonderful church. It stood on a high hill in the midst of a great city, and every Sunday, as well as on other sacred days like Christmas, thousands of people climbed the hill to its great archways, looking like lines of ants all moving in the same direction. When you came to the building itself, you found stone columns and dark passages and a grand entrance leading to the main room of the church. The room was so long that, standing at one end of the doorway, you could scarcely see to the other end. In the farthest corner was the organ, and this organ was so loud that sometimes when it played, the people for miles around would close their shutters and prepare for a great thunderstorm. But the strangest thing about the whole building was the wonderful chime of bells. At one corner of the church there was a great gray tower with ivy growing over as far as it could see, and the tower rose high into the sky so far that it could only be seen in the fairest of weather. Now all the people knew that at the top of the tower was a chime of Christmas bells. They had hung there ever since the church had been built and were the most beautiful bells in the world. But the fact was that no one had ever heard them, at least not for years and years. There was one old man living not far from the church who said that his mother had heard them once when she was a little girl. They were Christmas chimes, you see, and it was the custom on Christmas Eve for all the people to bring to the church their offerings to the Christ child. And when the greatest and best offering was laid on the altar, the chimes would ring. Some said that the wind rang them, and others that they were so high that the angels could set them swinging. But for many long years they had never been heard. It was said that the people had been growing less careful of their gifts for the Christ child, and no offering was brought great enough to deserve the music of the chimes. Every Christmas Eve, the rich people still crowded to the altar, each one trying to bring some better gift than the other, without giving anything that he wanted for himself. And the church was crowded with those who thought that perhaps the wonderful bells might be heard again. But although the service was splendid and the offerings plenty, only the roar of the wind could be heard far up in the stone tower. Now, a number of miles from the city, in a little country village where nothing could be seen of the great church but glimpses of the tower when the weather was fine, there lived a little boy named Pedro and his younger brother. They knew very little about the Christmas chimes, but they had heard of the service in the church on Christmas Eve, and they had a secret plan, which they often talked about by themselves, to go and see the beautiful celebration. The day before Christmas was bitterly cold, with a few lonely snowflakes flying in the air and a hard white cross on the ground. Sure enough, Pedro and little brother were able to slip quietly away early in the afternoon, and although the walking was hard in the frosty air, before nightfall they had trudged so far, hand in hand, that they saw the lights of the big city just ahead of them. And then they saw something dark in the snow. It was a poor woman who had fallen just outside the city, too sick and too tired to get in where she may have found shelter. The soft snow made a drift and a sort of a pillow for her, and so she would soon be sound asleep in the wintry air, and no one would ever wake her again. All this Pedro saw in a moment, and he knelt down beside her and tried to rouse her, even tugging at her arm a little, as though he would have to carry her away. He turned her face toward him so that he could run some snow on it, and when he looked at her silently there for a moment, he said to his brother, "Little brother, it is no use. You will have to go on alone." "Alone," cried little brother, "and you not see the Christmas festival?" "No," said Pedro, and he could not blink back the tears. "You see this poor woman, her face looks like the Mary in the chapel window, and she will freeze to death if nobody takes care of her. Everyone has gone to the church now, but when you come back, you can bring someone to help her.
and I will stay with her in the snow. I will rub her to keep her from freezing, and perhaps she can eat the bun that I have left in my pocket. But I cannot bear to leave you alone and go, said Little Brother. Both of us need not miss the service, said Pedro, and it had better be I than you who stays. You can easily find your way to the church, and you must see and hear everything twice, once for me and once for you. For I am sure the Christ child must know how much that we love him. And if you get the chance, little brother, slip up to the altar without anybody noticing, and take this piece of silver of mine. I have been saving up for it all year long. Take it and place it upon the altar with the offering. Do not forget where you have left me, and forgive me for not going with you. In this way, he hurried little brother off to the city and winked hard to keep back the tears as he heard the crunching footsteps sounding farther and farther away into the twilight. The great church was a wonderful place that night. Everyone said that it had never looked so bright and beautiful before. When the organ played and the thousands of people sang, the walls shook with the sound, and little Pedro, away outside the city wall, felt the earth tremble around him. At the close of the service came the great procession with the offerings to be laid on the altar. Rich men and great men marched proudly down to lay their gifts to the Christ child. Some brought wonderful jewels, some baskets of gold so heavy that they could scarcely be lifted. A great writer laid down a book that he had been working on for many years. And last of all walked the king. And there was a great murmur through the church as the people saw that the king would take his royal crown from his head and set it down on the altar. And surely, everyone said, we will now hear the bells ring, for nothing like this has ever happened before. But still only the cold wind was heard in the tower, and the people shook their heads. And some of them said that they had never believed the legend of the chimes anyway, and doubted if they ever rang at all. When the procession was over and the choir finished singing its closing hymn, just then little brother had worked his way down the side aisle of the church. And as the old minister stepped out in front of the congregation and raised his hands to give the benediction, little brother finally made his way to the altar, and he took Pedro's silver piece and he placed it there on the altar. And as he did, distinctly, there was the most beautiful sound they had ever heard.
Craig Coker is acting dean of Duke Chapel and director of religious life at Duke University. And for this holiday, that's the state of things. Thanks to all our guests on today's special holiday show, Doug Marlette, Jeffrey Beam, Sheila K. Adams, Mark Kemp, and Craig Coker. Happy holidays from the production staff here at the State of Things. We are Susan Davis, Dave DeWitt, Corey Princell, Jordana Gustafson, Stephanie Hirsch, Keith Weston, Robin Copley, and Fred Wasser. Support for the State of Things comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Thanks for listening. Happy holidays. I'm Melinda Pencava.